So let me start with this. It's pretty common in our current Western society to think the following two things. First, that the existence of God is a matter of faith for those who believe. Second, that those things that are a matter of faith are things that cannot be reasoned about. Right? So, the existence of God in particular cannot be reasoned about because it's a matter of faith. Right? This is a fine argument if you accept these two assumptions, that it's a matter of faith and matters of faith can't be reasoned about. However, the New Testament is not very friendly to this kind of reasoning. The New Testament is actually very big on the idea of reason. The Gospel of John, the first verses of it could be translated as, in the beginning was reason, and reason was with God, and reason was God. Now, you may not have heard this translation. You may have heard it with word in place of reason. But the Greek word logos means just as much reason as it does word. God is presented as a rational being, and the world that is created through the reason or the logos is a rational world. More specifically, regarding these two statements, the New Testament tells us things that are contrary claims. So Paul, writing to the Romans, and echoing ideas from the Book of Wisdom from around the 2nd century BC, says, ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So Paul is not thinking that the existence of God is a matter of faith. He's thinking it's something that is clearly visible from creation, from what exists. And secondly, Peter says, always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you. So we actually have kind of a twofold objection from the New Testament to 1 and 2. First of all, Paul tells us that the existence of God is not a matter of faith, it's a matter of clear perception. For Paul, there is a contrast between clear perception and faith. And secondly, even if it was a matter of faith, then Peter, in his letter, says we should be able to make a defense of things that are of faith. A reasonable defense, an apologia. So, what I want to do is talk about this first part, that God's invisible nature is perceived in the things that have been made. I want to offer one kind of argument that's not new as a whole. It's been given for a very long time. St. Thomas Aquinas was one of the famous people who gave a version of this argument, but it's been given by people before him and people after him. And it's called the cosmological argument. And it's going to be an argument that God exists. I was tasked with showing that God exists by the Thomistic Institute when invited here. I have a choice. I could give a whole bunch of arguments quickly, or one argument slowly. If I gave a whole bunch of arguments quickly, I'll be kind of glossing over points. And I thought it'll be better to spend time and go in greater detail into one particular argument. So it's going to be one particular argument, but it's going to be broken up into bits and pieces. The thought behind the argument is something like this. And so this is actually something that kind of cuts both ways. It seems to me that if God made everything, we would expect some kind of a sign of God in all of in creation. So, if you think God exists, that should lead you to expect there to be such signs. On the other hand, if you don't find such signs of God in creation, that seems to be some evidence that God doesn't exist. Because you would expect an author to put to be in some way discernible from what they've made. Okay, so I want to argue that, in fact, the existence of God is something that one can find signs of in creation. So the main argument I'm going to give, the cosmological argument, works something like this. We'll go through it step by step. And I'll spend a bit of time on every single one of the premises in some detail, sometimes some of them more than others. The first premise is that something causes something. I'm causing you to hear my words by moving my mouth, for example. Okay, easy. Second, there is no circularity of causes. You don't have cases where, you know, A causes B, and B causes C, and C causes A again. You don't have, you know, imagine somebody said, here's where human life came from. In the year 2500, somebody time traveled, two people time traveled to the year 200,000 BC and started the human race and had all sorts of children and so on up to the 25th century when they time traveled back in sort of this endless circle. This premise of the argument, this step in the argument says, no, that's not how it was. And I'm going to, you know, this is not very controversial, but I'll say a little bit more about this. Next step. There is no infinite backwards chain of causes. What does this mean? This step in the argument is going to say that if you look at the causes of things, you're going to have to come to a stop. You can't go on forever. So your cause, let's say, your cause is your parents. Their cause is your grandparents. Their cause is your great-grandparents. We go further back, right? We can keep on going back, you know, through human history, to prehistory, and, you know, to the first humans, which are in at least some sense caused by evolutionary processes. You can go further and further back. This premise says you're not going to be going back infinitely far. You're not going to go infinitely far back. And I put in parentheses that this premise comes from the Islamic Kalam school. So in the Middle Ages, Islamic philosophy was at the forefront, was the state of the art for quite a while. And Islamic philosophers came up with very creative arguments against the idea of infinite chains of causes. And I'll talk more about this. The arguments I'll give are not exactly the ones that Kalam people gave, but they are similar to them in spirit. Second line of thought, from another great medieval figure, Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas Aquinas says, even if the universe was eternal, even if it had always existed, even if your parents had parents and their parents had parents and this went on forever, Thomas Aquinas thought you still would need some kind of a first cause of the whole infinite chain of causes. And I'll talk about why you might think this. Either way, there's a first cause. By the Kalam school, so you've got a cause of something, no circularity of causes, so you've got it as you go further back in causation, you've got it, according to Kalam school, you've got to come to something that has no cause. According to Thomas Aquinas, even if you go on forever, you'll still need some cause outside of it. So there is a first cause. A first cause is something that is not itself caused, but is a cause. Something that does things, but nothing produced it. And then the next part, and this is a very controversial part of the argument, and a very difficult one, and I'm not going to spend quite as much time on this as I would like to, is that the first cause is God. So this is the argument. Right? So if you accept, of course, all these steps, one through four, you're going to conclude that there is a first cause, that there's some kind of cause of everything, that there's some kind of first cause of anything that has a cause. And then I will argue that the first cause is God. And then, you will argue against me in the discussion. You'll find holes in my argument and things that I've missed, because hopefully, or at least hopefully if I have missed them, you will find them. And I expect I have missed some things. So start with this first. So the way I'm going to divide up this talk is I'm just going to take each of the steps in the argument one by one and just talk about each one. So, you know, I am an analytic philosopher. That means that our approach is we break up arguments into steps as carefully as we can, and we try to look at each step in the argument very carefully and precisely as much as we can. So that I'm going to try to do this. So the first step is something causes something. Well, I already mentioned one thing. Your parents have caused you to exist. That's a good reason to believe that someone caused something. It's pretty obvious. Modern scientific explanations often give causes, right? We are evolutionary processes, modern science says, cause our existence. Now, maybe there are some people who are not convinced by this, but those people tend to think something else caused us, maybe an intelligent designer or something. But everybody agrees there is a cause. Human beings didn't just pop into existence out of nowhere, whether 6,000 or 200,000 or 500,000 or whatever number of years ago. We had a cause of some sort. My own view is it had, at least in part, was an evolutionary process, but the details don't matter. Modern science, in general, is largely based on experiments. What we do in experiments is we carefully cause effects, right? We try to control things. We try to control this factor, keep this one fixed, while we cause an effect with some other factor. This whole method of science, of scientific experiment and controlled experiments is one that only makes sense if there is such a thing as one thing causing another. Now, this sounds really kind of, you know, I seem to be wasting my time. Like, why am I even bothering to argue for something as obvious as the fact that one thing causes another? Well, part of it is kind of just professional need, because there are actually philosophers who deny this. There are philosophers who don't believe in causation. They just think it's just one thing after another in the universe, and there is no such thing as causation. I think it's hard to have that view and accept the practice of science. Okay. So this is not a controversial. Let's go on to something slightly more controversial, but still not very controversial, that there is no, that causes can't go in circles, that you can't, you know, have me, you know, time travel back and be my own great-grandfather and thereby be my own cause. Start with this thought: nothing can cause itself. Why? Because if something caused itself, it would in some sense be before itself. Right? The effect presupposes the cause. Well, if it presupposes the cause, you need the cause to get the effect. I mean, it would be like something causing itself would be like a class that was its own prerequisite. You couldn't sign up for a class like that. You could have a class that's its own co-requisite. You have to take it at the same time as itself. In fact, you do always take a class at the same time as itself. But you couldn't take a class as a prerequisite for itself. And a cause is, I think, a kind of prerequisite for the effect. So I don't think it's possible to have a thing that is causing itself. And I think for exactly the same reason, you can't have a circle of causes. You can't have A cause B and B cause C and then C cause A, as then A would be before B and B before A. You'd have, like, if the effect presupposes the cause, has the cause the prerequisite, B would be the prerequisite for C, A would be the prerequisite for B. And let's say you really want to take class C. Well, unfortunately, C is a prerequisite for A. You'd be in trouble. You could never sign up for a class like that. So I think it can't happen. I don't think you can have a circle of causes where one thing causes another. Again, I'm spending some time on something that's not super controversial, but the thing is that we are dealing with really deep and difficult questions. The question of where does the universe come from? And
It's hard to get answers, and people have, in fact, tried all sorts of answers, including the answer that the universe somehow caused itself, or even that, like, it goes on, develops for a long time, and then time travels back to cause the beginning. There have been physicists who have tried these kinds of options. I don't think that it makes philosophical sense to have something that causes itself, either directly or indirectly through a circle. But it is something that does need to be noticed, and maybe somebody will here will want to talk about this. If there is no circularity of causes, if causes can't go in a circle, then as we go back from effect to cause, let's say your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, we have one of two options. Either we're going to reach a first uncaused cause. Somewhere we'll have to just stop. I don't know. Maybe your great-grandparents have no cause. Unlikely. But, you know, that's a possibility. You reach a first uncaused cause in that chain. That's one option. The other option is you have an infinite regress. You just go on forever. So we're going to talk about these two options. If you don't have a circle of causes, we have a chain of causes. And we either reach something uncaused or we have an infinite regress. And Thomas Aquinas says that even if we have an infinite regress, we still reach a first uncaused cause. So we'll get there. Okay. I want to talk about something. This next step. That there isn't any infinite backwards chain of causes. This is super controversial. This and the next premise are the two really most controversial parts of this argument. For a while, the most common way for atheists to think about the universe was that it had no beginning, and that the past was infinite, and that causation went back infinitely far. Before Darwin, the thought was probably most commonly, I think, that the human race probably just went on forever. We had parents, they had parents, and so on forever. Human race always being there. The ancient Greeks, even though they were not atheists, some of them thought this. In the 20th century, this line of thought became rather less popular. It became less popular because of the work of a Catholic priest, Father Lemaître, who came up with the theory of the Big Bang. And Father Lemaître came up with this theory that the universe all started sort of all together billions of years ago and expanded. Initially, he was a scientist, he was an astronomer, but initially this theory was dismissed on the grounds that he's just doing this to push his theology. That he's doing this because he wants to prove the existence of God. As far as I know, he wasn't doing anything like that. He wasn't actually interested in arguing for the existence of God. He was just being a scientist and following the data where it led. Initially, the data wasn't conclusive. But as science through the 20th century developed, these ideas became entrenched and the scientific evidence seemed to show that the universe does in fact have a beginning. The main evidence for that is that the universe is expanding, so if we track it backwards, it should all come straight back to a single point. But that point would have to have like infinite density and infinite energy, and that's a singularity, and that doesn't seem like you could have that. So that seems like that's a point beyond which we can't track things back. And then there's some more recent work that suggests that maybe, in fact, there's just none. If you've got this kind of expansion, there's no way you could track. It could be infinitely old. So from a scientific point of view, the idea of the universe being infinitely old has become much less popular in the 20th century, and is still not that popular in the 21st century. But, you know, so we have good reason to think there was something like a Big Bang about 14 billion years ago. But maybe there's something before the Big Bang.
It's hard to talk of time before the Big Bang because of how space and time are all mixed together. When all the space collapses, it's hard to think of any time before that. But even if there is no time before the Big Bang, maybe you'd wonder, maybe there's something outside of time before the Big Bang, and something before that, and something before that. And so maybe you still have an infinite chain of causes, even if there is a Big Bang. So I think the Big Bang is some evidence that we don't have an infinitely far, a chain of causes going infinitely far back, but it doesn't, it's not inescapable. I think an atheist could still have this old idea that there's an infinite chain of causes that produce the universe. They could just think there's something that produced the Big Bang, maybe something outside of time, and something that produced that, and something that produced that. Well, here we can actually sort of jump from modern science to the Middle Ages and to this idea that medieval Muslim philosophers in the Kalam school had, that you cannot have infinite chains. And they came up with very clever arguments. And the ones I'm going to give are not theirs. I'm actually not convinced by their arguments. I don't find them that convincing, but I'm inspired by them. And so I and some other people have tried to come up with new arguments that you can't have an infinite chain of causes. And so I'm going to try to give you some of these arguments. And so let me try. The basic idea is going to be this. If you think it's okay to have an infinite past and an infinite chain of causes, then you're going to get some very strange paradoxes. And the best way out of these paradoxes is to say causation has to be kind of finite in nature. Nothing can have an infinite causal history. So I'm going to give you some paradoxes. I think none of the ones I'm going to give you in this talk have been invented by me. They're all other people's paradoxes. Let's start with this one. This is not my favorite paradox, but it's really easy to understand. It's called Thomson's lamp. I heard over dinner that somebody has a version of it involving a giant activating a lamp. I haven't heard that formulation. The idea is this. This came up in sort of discussions of the nature of time that had nothing directly in common with discussions of the existence of God. In the 1950s, this philosopher named Thomson came up with this thought experiment. Imagine a lamp with a push button. And each time you push the button, it toggles on and off. Okay? Right? So each time you press the button, it toggles on and off. And now he said, imagine that you press it in the that it works as follows. The thick lines indicate when it's on. Before 10 a.m., the light is on, he says. At 10 a.m., you press the button, so the light turns off. Okay, so then it stays off. Until at 10:30, you press the button again. All right. Now it turns on. Okay. You wait a little bit of time, not as long as you waited here, until 10:45. You press the button again. Now it turns off. You wait a little more until 10:52 and a half. You press the button and it turns on. And it turns off because you press it again. And then you turn on. What you do is after each one, you cut the remaining amount of time between that time and 11 o'clock and half. And you just insert a button and press. You don't press the button at 11 o'clock, but you press it faster and faster. So the first button press happens after half an hour, the next one after 15 minutes, the next one after 7 and a half, the next one after, 3.75 minutes, and so on. They get faster and faster. By 11 o'clock, you've pressed the button infinitely many times. So now the question, if you think that it's okay to have infinite causal chains of causes going backwards, you should be okay with this. You should think, yeah, this should happen. This could happen. I mean, here we just have an infinite chain of causes before 11 o'clock. This seems okay. But of course, the big question now is, what happens here after 11 o'clock? Is the lamp on or off? When I told this paradox to one of my kids, he said, well, that depends on whether infinity is even or odd. Right?
After an odd number of button presses, it's off, and after an even number, when it's on.
But of course, infinity is neither even nor odd. The concept of even and odd doesn't apply to infinity.
I mean, after all, infinity is infinity plus one. So if it were even, it would also be odd, because one plus an even number is odd. So it's neither, really. And so it seems like we've got this unanswerable question if we allow this paradox. Okay. Now, I actually am not
that impressed by this.
I think somebody could just say, if you did, the theory just doesn't tell you, we just don't know which one it will be. It might be on, it might be off. There's no contradiction in its being off. There's no contradiction in its being on. We don't know which one it will be. I'm still not very comfortable with that. Like, I mean, it seems like the state of the lamp should depend just on the button presses. And it shouldn't be a mystery whether it's on or off. Okay, maybe. Again, this is just one weird thing about infinity. Let me give you some more. The next one I like a lot more. And this one's, I think, really deeply paradoxical. Here is the story. Imagine Fred, who is alive, and a Grim Reaper. Grim Reapers are special kinds of beings that can cut off people's heads. And what you don't see in this picture is they carry an alarm clock. The alarm clock is set to some particular time. When the alarm clock rings, the Grim Reaper looks at Fred and checks if he is alive. If Fred is alive when the alarm clock rings, the Grim Reaper promptly chops off his head. And Fred is dead. Now, a few more new details. We suppose in the story that the only thing that's available to kill Fred are the Grim Reapers. We suppose that the Grim Reapers can work really, really fast in cutting off heads. It's easy for the Grim Reapers to tell whether Fred is alive or dead, because the only way for him to be killed is having his head cut off, and it's easy to tell if someone's head is cut off. So they don't have to check Fred's pulse or take time to do that. They just look at his head. Okay, and they never fail. Grim Reapers, I'm supposing, are beings that can never fail. Now, there doesn't seem to be any logical contradiction in anything I said. This all seems possible. Maybe not exactly real world, because in the real world there are other causes. You know, Fred could always, you know, swallow his tongue and die from that. But we're just sort of idealizing by supposing the only possible cause of death is a Grim Reaper. Seems like perfectly possible. Well, if you can have one Grim Reaper, and you're okay with infinitely many causes, you should be okay with infinitely many Grim Reapers. All right. So let's suppose we have infinitely many Grim Reapers. And let's suppose that their alarms are set to different times. And I will tell you about their times that the alarms are set for. First of all, at 10 o'clock, Fred is alive. One Grim Reaper has its alarm clock set for 10:30. Another for 10:15, another for 10:07.5, another for, you know, half of that number of minutes, I think 3.75, I think. Yeah, 3.75, 10:03.75, another one for half of that, and so on. None of them has its alarm set for 10 o'clock. There are infinitely many of them. Okay, I mean, look, if you can have infinitely many Grim Reapers, they can have their alarm set for whatever time you like. So they could have it set for this time. All right. Well, what's going to happen to Fred? Well, you know what's going to happen. He's going to be dead. Not a problem as to what's going to happen. He's going to be dead by 11 o'clock. But let's figure out when he will die. Because when we find out when he died, they'll tell us the cause of death, namely which Grim Reaper did it, which we might want to know. You know, maybe we want to put them on trial or deactivate the one that actually did the deed. So let's figure out which Grim Reaper cut off Fred's head. Well, he's the 10:30 one, maybe. That's the last of the Grim Reapers. Could he have killed Fred?
No, he could not have killed Fred, and here's why. Because Fred was already dead before 10:30. Why? Because there was a Green Reaper who woke up at 10:15. The Green Reaper who woke up at 10:15 either found that Fred's head was already off, in which case it stayed off, or he found out that Fred was alive and cut off his head. Either way, after 10:15, Fred is dead. So 10:30 Green Reaper had nothing to do with it. When the 10:30 Green Reaper woke up, looked at Fred, and saw that the head was not on the neck, and did nothing. Okay, maybe the 10:15 one killed Fred. Except the argument repeats. Before 10:15, Fred was already dead, because there was a 10:07.5 Reaper, and that Green Reaper either killed Fred or found him already dead. So this one, before 10:15, Fred was already dead. That's pretty complicated. But you see the pattern. The 10:15 Green Reaper couldn't have killed him. Maybe the 10:07.5 one did. No, because he was already dead before that, because there was a Green Reaper who activated before that. Before every Green Reaper, there was an earlier Green Reaper. There are infinitely many. They bunch up at 10 o'clock. For the math students, the set of times of Green Reapers as a limit point, 10 o'clock.
So,
here's what we learned.
None of the Green Reapers killed him, and he's dead. And the only thing that could have killed him was a Green Reaper. Okay, now this is really weird. This is sounding like, not just, we don't know what happened, like in the previous one. We don't know what would happen in the story.
This is a story where it seems like we get a contradiction. You put in these infinitely many causes, and now you have to say, he's dead, but nothing, and the only things that could have killed him are Green Reapers, and nothing, and none of them killed him.
This is a real paradox.
Okay.
Give you another one. My kids are really fond of this one.
It's called Smulyan's Rod. This philosopher by the name of Smulyan came up with this. I think it was in the 19th, sort of toward the end of the 20th century. Here is a rod. Imagine this rod is perfectly rigid. It doesn't bend. Now this one is not. It bends slightly under the force of gravity. If you were to look, it's actually slightly curved. But imagine it was perfectly rigid. I couldn't balance it on the tip of my finger at the end. I would have some hope of doing it in the middle, but by the end, no, no way. Because what's going to happen is it will fall. All right. Now imagine the rod was longer. It would get harder to balance on the tip, right? I mean, you know, if it's really short, maybe I have some hope. It's like just the length of a cap. I can maybe balance it on the end. But if three markers, there's no way. If it's four, it's even harder. If it's five, it's even harder, right? The longer the rod is, the harder it is to balance on, you know, a little fulcrum like here. But now imagine this. Imagine this rod is perfectly rigid, impenetrable, and is lying above a horizontal surface that is infinitely long. Maybe imagine you're on a flat earth, like, you know, people believed in thousands of years ago. But they probably didn't believe in an infinite one, but this one is infinite. And so it's flat and infinite, perfectly flat, and goes on forever, right here. Okay? And this rod is also infinitely long in one direction to the right. Now imagine I try to balance it. Now it's got to be really hard to balance because it's way longer. No, it actually now becomes perfectly easy to balance. The rod is just going to stay there like that and not bend and not go down. Here's why. It can't go down. Why? Imagine if it were to go down. Then it starts off parallel to the ground. If it were to go down, there would be some angle it would make with the horizontal. Two lines that are not parallel, it would no longer be parallel to the ground. Two lines that are not parallel meet. So the rod would have to touch the earth. And then it would have to go through the earth because it's perfectly rigid. So it can't bend when it hits the earth. So whatever little angle the rod had, it would end up hitting the earth. And it can't hit the earth. It can't go through the earth. So it can't have that angle. So it has to be a smaller angle. So there's in fact no angle it can have. It can't bend even a tiny, tiny little angle, because if it did, it would hit the earth and then go through the earth, being perfectly... But the earth is rigid and impenetrable too, we can suppose, in this story. So now this paradox that if the rod is infinite, it would hang above the surface of the earth forever, if the earth was infinite and flat, and can't bend and go down at all. That seems wrong. That seems paradoxical.
Okay, so
something's wrong. We've got three stories: the lamb, the green reapers, and the rod. And there's actually a lot more stories like these that you can tell. There's something wrong with them.
What's the way out? What's the solution? Here's my story. I think that the conclusion you can make from all of these stories is you cannot have a case where infinitely many causes impinge on a single effect. You cannot have a lamp where each of the infinitely many button pressings affects the final state of the lamp. You cannot have a case where infinitely many green reapers in some way affect Fred's state. In the rod case, that would also be a case where there are infinitely many causes, because like there's this, there's the earth here that's impenetrable and keeping it from going down, and the earth here and the earth here, infinitely many bits of the earth keeping it up. I think when we think about these paradoxes and others like them, the conclusion we want to make is a thesis I call causal finitism, which says you cannot have infinitely many causes in a single effect. I call it causal finitism. Finitism means things have to be finite. Causal means you having to do with causation. So I'm thinking, if you've got causes of something, you can only have finitely many of them. Otherwise, you get into all sorts of weird paradoxes like these. If this is the best way to kill these paradoxes, this is probably the right answer, and causal finitism, I think, is probably true, because it's the best way to kill these paradoxes. But if it's true, then you can't have an infinite backwards chain of causes, which is what we were on.
We were looking at this thing, no infinite backwards chains. Because an infinite backwards chain, like you are being caused by your parents by their parents, and their parents by their parents, that would be infinitely many causes impinging on you. And if causal finitism is true, that can't be done.
And if you think it can be done, then you need some other way out of these paradoxes. That could be one thing we can discuss afterwards. Okay. So that's one line of thought, is you can't have this infinite regress of causes. Here's a different line of thought. This comes from not the Muslim side, but the Christian side. So in the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas was not convinced by the Kalam school's arguments. He famously argued that we cannot show that the universe is not infinitely old. In fact, he said he thought we can take it on faith, but we can't show it philosophically. He said, you know, the Bible says in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, so that's how on faith we can know that the universe has a finite past, but we can't prove that philosophically, he thought. But he thought that even if it was infinitely old, it would still need a first cause. That was his move. Is he thought you can still argue that God exists even if you can't rule out the possibility of an infinite chain of causes. So I want to just explore a quick thought along those lines. So this is a parallel thing. In ancient times, people asked why the earth doesn't fall down. This was like a really big scientific problem around the 5th century BC in Greece. So this was maybe 6th century BC. This was at a time when people thought that the earth was at least flattish, maybe a little bowl-shaped.
And now they observe that anything that's sort of earthy falls down. Any earthy solid stuff. Not everything falls down. Clouds and vapors and fire go up. But earthy stuff goes down. And the earth is made of earthy stuff. So it should go down. It should be falling. Because all the earthy stuff falls down. So should the earth. So they asked, why doesn't the earth fall down? One answer was that it lay on top of something else. But of course, you could then ask, why doesn't the thing it falls on, it lies on top of, say the giant tortoise, fall down? Well, you could try to say that that giant thing is on top of something else. And then you would ask, why doesn't that fall down? And that very naturally leads you to an infinite regress of things. Like, maybe the earth is on top of an infinite pillar of things. But if you think about it, you realize, even if the earth was on top of an infinite pillar of tortoises going all the way down, you still wouldn't have an answer as to why it doesn't fall down. Because you'd still have the question, why doesn't the whole column of tortoises and earth all fall down? After all, it's immensely heavy, it's infinitely heavy. It should fall down. For the same reason that you think they thought the earth would fall down, you think the whole column would fall down. I remember one ancient Greek philosopher's text. I have never been able to track down the text. I read it years ago in a collection, and I couldn't track it down since. Said, the earth rests on long pillars whose bottoms are shrouded in mist. He didn't want you to ask about what the pillars are on. He knew there was a problem there, so he covered it over with mist. We don't want to do that. So I think even if you have an infinite chain of tortoises or columns or whatever for the earth, you still need an explanation of why the whole chain, this whole infinite thing, doesn't fall down. And I think there's a lesson from this. Now, we no longer care about this question why the earth doesn't fall down. The reason we don't care about it is because we think the earth is round. And that just makes the whole question not work in the same way. And because gravity points towards the center of the earth, and so all the earthy stuff, yeah, it's compressed towards the center of the earth, but then the pressure from within resists. Aristotle realized this in the 4th century BC. He realized that once we take the earth to be round and gravity to be pointing inward, the problem disappears. So it was like a 5th century BC problem with a solution in the 4th century BC. But even though we're not worried about why the earth doesn't fall down, there's a lesson we can learn from this, that even if you have an infinite chain of causes, there's still a question, why do you have this whole chain of causes? Where does this whole infinite chain of causes come from? Just like, why doesn't the whole infinite chain of causes fall down? That's still just as much a question to be asked. It's still unexplained. Now, the most common response by atheist thinkers is that some things just happen with no explanation. Maybe you just have an infinite chain of causes and there's no reason why you have the infinite chain of causes. Now, I'd like to defend something called the principle of sufficient reason, which is a principle that says that things that don't have to happen always have a reason or explanation. So I didn't have to show up in San Antonio today, so there is an explanation as to why I showed up here. Maybe things that do have to happen, maybe they don't have an explanation, but things that don't have to happen have to have some kind of an explanation. The history of the universe is one of those things that didn't have to happen, I think. Why? Well, the universe is so very particular. It has this shape, this geometry, it's made of this kind of matter. That doesn't seem like a sort of thing that just had to happen. There's just, why did it have to have this particular weight, this mass, and so on? There seems to be so much about it that didn't have to happen. So I think it needs an explanation, even if it's infinite. The standard answer to this is just to deny this principle that everything that doesn't happen has a reason or explanation. My own view is that if you deny this principle that everything that doesn't have to happen has an explanation, then you're also undercutting the foundations of modern science. Because I think that one of the central foundations of modern science is this principle of inference to best explanation. It says we should go for the best explanation of the theory. But if there's always a possibility that just something just happened for no reason at all, well, then why should we go for the best explanation? Isn't it simpler to just say it just happened for no reason at all? That seems simpler than having a theory about it. And so I think inference to best explanation is only works if you think that there will always be explanations for things. And if you think there will be always explanations for things, you will not be satisfied with an infinite chain of causes, just as nobody should have been satisfied with an infinite chain of tortoises. And I don't know if anybody actually was, historically. I doubt it. You should not be satisfied. You should think, even if there was an infinite chain of causes of the universe, there had to be something outside that chain that caused it. And that's Thomas Aquinas' insight, is that even so, you still need a cause. So, here's to sum up where we've got. If there cannot be infinite backwards chains of causes, we have to come to one or more first cause. What do I mean by first cause? Something that is a cause but is not, doesn't have its own cause. And Thomas Aquinas argued that even if there is an infinite backwards chain of causes, it still needs a cause. So we've got kind of two different ways of getting to the idea of a first cause. So there's a first cause, which is itself uncaused. That's the first controversial conclusion.
But in theory, this is a conclusion that actually an atheist could accept. An atheist could say, yeah, there is a first cause. Maybe it's the Big Bang. Maybe it's the universe. Maybe it's something. Maybe it's aliens who created this universe. It's an option.
I don't think it's the best one. And this is the part where I'm going to be really quick. And maybe we can get more into this in discussion. I think the first cause
needs to be something that doesn't just happen to exist just by chance, like aliens that just happen to exist. It needs to be something where it doesn't make sense to ask why does it exist. So we need an answer to this question of why the universe exists where it doesn't make sense to ask why is that so. So it has to be the kind of thing that has to exist. None of the items that science talks about is like that. Science talks about what philosophers call contingent things, things that don't have to exist. Evolutionary processes, which are random, and if you were to rerun it, would happen differently. Particular laws of nature that have particular numbers in them. Surely you could have other numbers in them. So no item that science talks about is something that has to exist. So the first cause is something that has to exist. It doesn't just happen to exist. I think it has to be something supernatural. Because it's not something among the things that science talks about. And I think, sort of by definition, the supernatural is precisely those things science doesn't talk about. Science is great, but it doesn't talk about everything. Next thought. We should prefer simpler theories over more complicated ones. That's not an insight of the science, of the practice of science. But the simplest theory as to the first causes is that there's only one of them. You could say, maybe there's seven. But it's a lot simpler to think there's only one. Also, the universe seems to have a unity to it, which suggests a single creator. The laws of nature, as far as we can tell, are the same everywhere. There are about 100 different kinds of particles. It's a very small number. And they just seem to be repeated endlessly throughout the universe. Again, this suggests like a single creator. Because again, some might make some one kind of thing here, another kind of thing here. But it seems like the whole universe is like very uniform in terms of the sort of stuff it's made of. That suggests a single creator. Obviously, any creator of the universe is very powerful. Also, yes, I love to think more about, and something I'm thinking a lot about right now, is the universe is very beautiful. It's beautiful in two different ways. It's beautiful to our senses,
but it's also beautiful to our minds, mathematically. The physics has beautiful equations in it.
And has life. This suggests a creator who's intelligent. It seems like intelligent beings are the ones that you would expect to create a mathematically beautiful universe. And in fact, a good one who cares about life, at least somewhat good. So I think we have good reason to think, once we say that there is a first cause, that this first cause is a very powerful, highly intelligent, supernatural creator. This is, I think, the simplest theory that explains where the universe comes from. It's a theory that says this being is infinite and perfect, and that it's God. Let me end with one last thought.
There is a suspicion in science of a theory that explains only one thing. So imagine that the theory of gravitation only explained why apples fall down. There would be something really deeply unsatisfying about that, right? We want our theories to explain many different things. So what I said so far has the danger of being a little bit like that, right? This being that I said, it explains why where the universe comes from. Well, the universe, though very big, is still just one, in some sense, one thing. So maybe you think, okay, maybe that's not very good. Maybe we want to explain other things. And I think I will come back, could come back and say yes. But this theory that there is this very powerful, highly intelligent, supernatural creator can also be used to explain other phenomena besides the existence of the universe. Phenomena like consciousness, which is one of the major scientific problems of explaining the possibility how things would matter to be conscious, the nature of morality, the meaning of life. So I think it's not this theory that there is a super powerful supernatural being is not just something that explains only one thing. It explains many different things that are actually also, and they're not unimportant. They're like essential things of importance to us, our existence, our consciousness, our morality, and the meaning of our lives. But I'm not, of course, giving much of an argument on this side yet in this talk. Thank you.
Okay, so at this point, if anyone has any questions, you're free to go ahead and ask those, or objections, whatever. I guess when it's such a small room, you might be able to just ask from your seat. Yeah, go ahead.
When you were talking about the arguments that allowed for infinite regression in terms of particularly the light, Thomson's light.
Yeah.
It occurred to me that that argument seems to rely on an almost infinite flexibility in time.
Hmm.
In other words, as the clicking of the light on and off became faster and faster and faster, time itself had to be able to appear in shorter and shorter increments to accommodate that.
Right.
And yet in basic physics, we have the idea of the Planck length and the Planck time, which means there isn't an infinite regression of the fabric of the universe. There is such a thing as the smallest amount of time that can exist.
I don't think that's what the physics says. I think it's more like we don't know what happens below the Planck length and the Planck time. I think that's probably the best way to interpret our current physics. That's kind of a limit to our understanding. I am friendly to the idea, though, that time does in fact have this ultimate limit. And both the Grim Reaper paradox and the Thomson's lamplight depend on this feature of time, that it can be infinitely subdivided. If you deny that, you want light, you have a different solution to those two paradoxes. There are a lot more. There's one I gave, the Simoleon's rod. There's a whole bunch of others that don't rely on infinitely subdividing time. They're kind of like, and I'm sorry, that sounds sort of like an argument from authority that there exist these paradoxes, but they're there. So I think there are alternate ways of resolving this paradox. My view is that these alternate ways of resolving these paradoxes are not going to resolve all of them.
That's great.
Could you explain the part where you said the universe did not have to happen?
Didn't have to happen. Yeah, that's a good question. So that's been sort of one common response to these kinds of arguments over time is, well, maybe the universe is just one of those things that has to be the way it is. It just had to happen.
Go back to the question.
The universe, though, is governed by laws of nature that, as far as we know, have all sorts of numbers in them, very precise numbers. And these numbers are not like neat and simple numbers always. And so think of, this is not exactly how it's going to work in the final physics, but think of the classical physics. So the force is between two things that have gravity between them is g times the product of the masses divided by the square of the distance. Now, 2 is a very neat little number, very nice and elegant. You could believe, maybe, that it just had to be 2. But g is a very messy number. I don't remember what it is. But in at least the metric system, it's a very messy number. It seems incredible that it had to be exactly that number. But if the universe is as it has to be, then it would have to be that. And there's a whole bunch of such numbers in the laws of physics. It also seems to me very arbitrary that the universe has, and to actually, I think a number of physicists as well, that the universe has 4 dimensions, 3 space plus 1 time. Maybe you could think, for philosophical reasons, you cannot have more or fewer time dimensions. I'm not sure about that. Maybe you can. But certainly, it seems perfectly possible mathematically to have 4 or 10 space dimensions, or 1 or 2. Why? It seems really incredible to think it had to be 3 of all the dimensions. And yet, if the universe has to exist, it would have to be 3. There's also sort of worries like, if the universe as a whole is necessary, well, I'm part of the universe. So where's my free will? Could there be any free will then if the universe as a whole is necessary? Could my parents have had any free will in causing my existence? So I think there's sort of multiple reasons to think the universe doesn't have to exist.
Here.
Hi. First, I just really want to point out that he's Alexander, I'm Alexander, the University of Chaplin's Alexander.
And I'm Alexander.
Yeah.
It's just all of us Alexanders talking together. Yeah.
We're all in one room. Everyone else is just...
And all together we'll make up Alexander the Great.
Anyway, I would like to bring up an idea about your very first premise.
Yeah.
About how something causes something.
Yeah.
So, in all the cases that I can think of, something always causes something in time. But before the universe, or before anything was created, there was no time.
Yeah.
So how can something cause something if causation is dependent upon time?
Yeah. So I guess the question is going to be whether the fact that the cases of causation that we observe are always in time gives us reason to think that all causation is in time. So we observe kind of 2 things. We observe all the things in time having causes, and we observe that these causes are in time, right? We could draw some conclusions from this. One is, we could think one of 2 principles. Everything in time as a cause in time. Or we could think everything
in time has a cause, but not be so sure whether that cause is in time. If we go for this one, we run into problems with the arguments further on, the Kalam arguments, the Big Bang, the infinities. So that's a reason not to buy this one. But the fact that all of them have a cause and time, I don't think that gives us reason to deny that. But that still leaves us open to take the second conclusion, that everything in time has a cause. But that cause doesn't have to be in time. Now, maybe there is a difficulty. How could something have a cause that's not in time? I don't see the difficulty. I don't see a reason to think that causation is something that requires time. It's true that all the cases of it that we observe involve time, but I don't think it has to. I mean, maybe time travel has some paradoxes in it, but at least I think we kind of understand time travel stories. We understand what it means to travel back in time. And so we could kind of understand what it means to have causation going in the opposite direction as time. Because when you have time travel, you have causation going in the opposite direction, because my pressing a button now causes a man to exit a time machine, say, in the time of the dinosaurs, if that's what I set my time machine for. That seems to make perfect sense. We understand what that means. I think that my pressing the button caused me to answer it. You might think that maybe it's not possible in the end, but at least we understand this word of what causation and time is. And that suggests, we actually understand the notion of time is not that tightly connected to causation. We understand what those words causation mean apart from time. It's not like this. Suppose somebody said, I have a bit of gold and it doesn't take up any space. You say, what is that? I have no idea what you're talking about. It's just really complete nonsense. But for causation, I don't think it's like that. I think we understand the notion of causation even apart from time. And so Christian thinkers historically, the predominant view has been that God is outside of time and has caused the universe. And I think not everybody agrees that is true. But I think you understand what that means. It's not like they're saying, there's this gold that we have that doesn't take up any space. So I think it makes sense. Now, whether it's possible is a further question, but I think it at least makes sense.
All the arguments about infinity being all based on the constraints of time and the third one, the constraints of space. Given that space and time are both relative, and that the universe is supposedly light speed, if you believe that infinity happened before the Big Bang, then could you not presume that there is an infinite before time and before space, to where those infinity arguments would not really work? So something created time and space at the Big Bang, and something created that something, and something created that something.
Well, first, the fact that time and space is relative, I think, doesn't affect these arguments.
I'm not sure they depend on the nature of space or time. So I'm not sure it matters what it is, what's going on there. Let me give you a different paradox. This one's a little complicated. But it goes like this. You have infinitely many people playing this game. Each one tosses a die. And after they toss it, they don't get to see their die. Okay? So you toss a die, you're one of these people, you don't get to see how it came out. And you have to guess whether it was a 6. If you guess right, you get a prize. If you guess wrong, you get punished. You get some electric shock. Obviously, there's something you should do. You should say, it's not a 6.
then you've got a 5 out of 6 chance of being right. That's obviously the right thing to do. But now imagine this. Imagine an angel announces to all the people that there are only finitely many dice that came up other than 6. Only finitely many came up other than 6. Almost all of them came up 6s. Where's the paradox? Well, it seems like at this point you should change your guess, on the one hand, because now you know that most of the dice are not 6s. So you find out there's infinitely many 6s, finitely many non-6s. So you think, I've learned something, I should change my mind. That seems perfectly reasonable, but the paradox is this, you actually haven't learned anything about your die when the angel told you that there are only finitely many non-6s, and here's why. What you learn from the angel is this statement. There are only finitely many non-6s. Right, that's what you learned. But here's something else that's exactly logically the same statement. There are only finitely many non-6s among other people's dice. Those two statements are actually, this is a little complicated logically, but those two statements are actually logically exactly equivalent. Here's why. You have only one die. Whether there are infinitely many non-6s or finitely many non-6s doesn't depend on your die. So to find out that there are only finitely many non-6s among other people's dice is the same as to find out there are only finitely many non-6s altogether, because your die never makes a difference. And so as a result, what you've learned from the angel is there are only finitely many non-6s among other people's dice, but that has no information about your dice, your die, at least if the dice are fair, and so you shouldn't change your mind. So you get these kinds of paradoxes with dice where you should change your mind and you shouldn't change your mind at the same time. There's a lot of detailed work of this paradox, but I want to say this. The details of these paradoxes don't seem to depend on a structure of space or time. They just seem to depend on infinitely many things causing the announcement by the angel. Yeah.
Sure, it may not have to do with space or time, but it's mathematical probabilities, and if you multiply an infinity by zero, it's undefined. But
yeah.
Undefined means that it's not only... Undefined means that it can be and is any number at the same time. It's like overlapping existences. If you're also to talk about, thinking of time is time can, if you're accelerating time exceptionally fast and observing from one point of view, you can say that time is passing at a slower time versus where you're at, and time is passing at a regular time. So time is passing at the same time at different rates, but it's,
sure.
But rate is also time dependent. So it's like, even with this math, it's overlapping existences.
I don't think that resolves the paradox.
It complicates causality by saying that something can cause something and also not cause it at the same time, because both can exist.
I don't think so. I don't think you get. I don't think relativity gives you any claim about how one thing can cause another but not that. Relativity is in fact sort of based on the kind of invariance of causal connections. So the reason relativity theory implies is usually taken to imply a speed of light limit on interactions is because if you had an interaction that happened faster than the speed of light, from one point of view, the effect would be before the cause, and from another point of view, the effect would be after the cause. People don't think that's acceptable. So the usual view is that causation has to go at or below the speed of light in at least space and time, and when that happens, you don't get these problems where one thing is before the other and that one's before it. You do that. That's the whole point of the speed of light limit, is to rule that out.
Let's go front
left, please.
How would you define, what is supernatural to you?
The sort of thing that is beyond the competence of science. Now that's what I said. What is the competence of science? That's a really hard philosophy of science question. I mean, there are people who try to figure this out. I don't know. We don't have a great answer to that. We have kind of this answer. So what is it that geologists study? Well, they study, the word geology comes from study of the Earth. Yeah, but also you have the geology of other planets nowadays. The U.S. Geological Survey puts out maps of other planets. What we think of as geology is something like, it's a study of, the kinds of rocks we have on Earth, and other stuff like that. It's somewhat vague. I think that's how a lot of sciences are defined. It's the study of these kinds of things and things like, things pretty much like them. So biology is the study of living things, but we have no agreement on what is the right way to define living things. Different biology textbooks will define it differently. Philosophers will define it differently. There isn't agreement on exactly what life is. And perhaps all we can say is, look, biology studies things like trees and people and bacteria and viruses. It's stuff like that that biology studies. And then you can add, that's not super satisfying. You can still ask, what about things that are sort of midway? What about a computer virus? Does biology study that? I guess probably not, but maybe it should. Or an artificial life form, or a robot, who knows? There are going to be vague cases where it's not clear, but there are going to be clear cases. Biology does not study markers. It doesn't study the sun, right? Geology, on the other hand, does not study me, or you, or dogs, or cats. There will be some in-between cases that may be hard to tell. Does geology study ice? Well, the naturally occurring ice, maybe. The ice in your fridge, probably not. But it's not clear. There are going to be sort of borderline cases. And I think we're okay. We should be okay with that when we ask this question, what are these particular sciences studying? And then the question, what science as a whole studies? I think it's just another question like that. So we could just say, science studies, things like rocks and people and particles and fields, stuff like that. And it's going to be kind of a vague area where we're not completely sure, is this like that? But it's still, I think, it's enough that we can make some kind of a useful judgment. We know science doesn't study ethics. I mean, there's such a thing as the ethics of science, but it's not a science itself. Science uses mathematics, but doesn't study mathematical objects. Likewise, so I think supernatural here is something like, what's not like the things science studies? The things that science studies, they all look like the sort of things that don't have to exist. And it's vague, but we're kind of stuck with that. This has nothing to do with the details here. It's just, we don't have a lot of things. The answer to this will be vague. Exactly what counts at the boundaries.
Yeah.
Back left.
Yes. I just have a problem, I guess, with your final conclusion in the sense that through your premising arguments, you have something that you argue that there is nothing that could cause. Everything has to have a cause or initial picture. That there's not a kind of backwards change, but in your conclusion, you seem to result in a thing or being that you label God as something that breaks all these rules, something that I guess goes against, that is something that causes something that comes from nothing and is considered by many infinite. So therefore, it would have an infinite history of events, the current surrounding it. And I have a problem with this because are there other things that you could label other than God to be this in first cause? You could see this in decaying principles or virtual particles. So I'm asking is why are you concluding to the reasoning of it being God?
Okay.
It breaks its entire argument.
Okay, that's a great question. I mean, if this was to break the entire argument, of course, that would mean that there's something wrong with the argument, right? It would be like arguing on scientific grounds that science can't work or something like that. We don't want to do that. I want to say, let's see, you said a lot of really interesting things. Probably can't keep track of all of them. Let me say few things. First, the principle of sufficient reason, as I put it, says that everything that does not have to happen has a reason or explanation. So if there's going to be some kind of an exception to things having causes, it'll have to be something, there could be such an exception, but it would have to be something that doesn't have, that has to happen. So for example, here's something that I don't know if it has any explanation. Maybe it does, but I'm not sure. Here's a fact that you learn at some point in school. Not a very hard math fact. Zero equals zero.
Why? I have no idea. I'm inclined to say it just has to be that way. And if you think about it, you'll see it just has to be that way. That's all there is to it. There's no further explanation. So some things like zero equals zero, are things that just have to be. Maybe the axioms of mathematics or something like that. And so only the things that don't have to happen need to have reasons. So I think one of the conclusions, upshots of the first cause argument, is that the first cause is one of those things that has to be. Has to exist. Now, the second thing you said, which is really interesting, I thought, is maybe this, what about this infinity stuff? You know, I said you can't have infinitely many causes impinge on something, and yet this being is, people call it, say it's infinite. Well, there's a difference between being infinite and there being infinitely many of you, or infinitely many parts, or infinitely many causes. What exactly one means by saying God is infinite is not actually all that clear. None of the great theologians in the Christian, Jewish, or Muslim traditions thought that God had a size, right? None of them thought God was a physical being. So they didn't think like God was infinitely large or had infinitely many organs when they said he has infinitely many fingers or something. So if God is infinite, he's not infinite in the way that, you know, an infinitely large human being would be or something, or an organism of infinitely many parts. It's not that kind of infinity. It's not an infinity of parts. In fact, this is one of the things that Thomas Aquinas argues, after arguing that there is a first cause, is one of the first things he tries to argue is that the first cause is something that doesn't have any parts at all.
It's just simple, he calls it. Simple means not having parts. It's, think of a, now this is not a great analogy, but think of a single particle, an electron, a fundamental particle. Electrons are fundamental as far as we know. They don't, they're not built up of smaller parts, further parts. And so the traditional view in, I think both in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, in the, was that God is a simple being. He has no parts. You might ask questions about the doctrine of the Trinity that one of these three religions holds. That's that people like Thomas Aquinas said, yeah, the persons of the Trinity are not parts either. That's a different way to understand that. So God doesn't have parts. So he's not like, it's not like there are infinitely many things working together. So he's infinite in a different way. Think of maybe it's a kind of infinity of intensity. An infinity of being beyond all the finite things. I don't know what it is. This argument, I didn't talk about being infinite in this argument. Now, what about the God's history? Wouldn't he have existed always and have had an infinite past, and then this infinite past would be an infinite number of causes? Again, these arguments, I think, point to a God who's outside of time. And so he doesn't, it's not true that he has an infinite, he's infinitely old. He's not old at all. He's not young at all. He's outside of time. He's timeless. He's not older than the universe. He's not younger than the universe. He's not the same age as the universe because he has no age, because age is a matter of time. And God is outside of time entirely. That was, again, Thomas Aquinas' view. And then I don't think we get this problem of an infinite history. If you do think, though, and there have been like process theologians and others, especially starting the 20th century, some theologians have thought God is in time, he has a past, then you do run into these problems, and you do in fact end up contradicting these arguments.
So I think we're going to stop there. Let's get another round of applause for Dr. Duff.